sang along. Others only pretended. None questioned his motives. They could see by the way he sang and by the way he looked to no one in particular as he strummed the guitar that the music came from his heart. At 11 p.m., Neuerberg and the crew returned to their regular barracks. One of the crewmen who had likely sung along that night was 19-year-old torpedoman Franz Nedo. Nedo nurtured two loyalties as he trained with U-869. The first was to Hitler and the Nazi Party. The second was to his fiancée, Gisela Engelmann, whose name he had written on one of the forward torpedo tube hatches, and who despised Hitler and the Nazis as much as her beloved Franz admired them. Nedel and Gisela had met in 1940, while she was attending a Hitler youth program in the countryside, and he was pursuing an apprenticeship as a butcher. He was 15, she 14. They loved each other straight away. He delighted in her free-thinking, fiery personality, and outgoing instinct. She adored his intellect. He seemed smart beyond his years, a thinker, and reveled in his compassion, his belly laugh, and even the way he spoke High German with the distinctive rolled R of his hometown region near Stettin. She was overwhelmed by Nadel's mastery of the butcher's craft. He oversaw the slaughter of animals with a confidence and equanimity she'd never seen in boys from her native Berlin. Inside a week, they were boyfriend and girlfriend. He called her Gila. She called him Frenza. They knew they would spend their lives together. The couple was inseparable. When he played accordion in the band he had formed with friends, she sang along and crowds would gather. And as they played their favorite song, a French tune with the lyrics, "Come back home, Zurich, come back, I'm waiting for you. You are all my happiness." She believed that there was only one true love in a person's life, and that she had found that love in Nadel. Nadel's gentle nature, however, seemed at odds with one of his passions. He was fascinated by U-boats. He spoke of them constantly, promising to enlist in the submarine service when the inevitable day came for him to join the military. Gila begged him to reconsider. "These are swimming coffins," she told him. "Get on a battleship or a cruiser. Get on anything besides the U-boat." "No, Gila," he replied time and again, "I want the U-boat." Gila told him she understood. She had a shakier grasp, however, on Nadel's political beliefs. The Nazis had imprisoned his father, a butcher, for holding anti-Hitler beliefs. Nadel did not speak much about his father's ordeal, but his mother told Gila that her husband had been locked up for a considerable time before being released. Nadel loved his father. Still, he found himself sympathetic to Hitler and the rise of the Third Reich. Gila's father also had been arrested by the Nazis. For months, he had delivered food and supplies to a Jewish family hiding in a nearby basement. In 1942, the Gestapo discovered the family. They hung the man by his feet from the ceiling, poured freezing water on him, and screamed, "Who is helping you?" When the man could take no more, he revealed that it was Gila's father who had hidden his family. The Gestapo took the man to Gila's house, where he pointed out her father and said, "I am so sorry. I could not take it any longer." Gila's father was arrested and sent to the Dachau concentration camp, where he remained even as Gila and Nadel were falling more deeply in love. When Gila asked her boyfriend how he could sympathize with the Nazis after such treatment of both their fathers, he could only say, "I am very sorry this has happened, Gila." Still, Gila loved Nadel deeply. He was kind and gentle to her, and envisioned a lovely future for them. As Nadel entered naval training in 1943, the couple became engaged. "I will take care of anything we need," he promised. "When the war ends, we will have our life, I promise you." That year, as Nadel left for home during leave from basic training, Gila waited for him at his mother's home. There she saw a photograph of Hitler hanging on the wall. She exploded. "Good God, you have his picture up!" she exclaimed. Before Nadel's mother could react, Gila took the photo from its frame and clawed out Hitler's eyes with her fingers. Then she placed the ruined photo in her fiancé's bed. "Oh, my God, what is he going to do when he comes home and sees that?" Nadel's mother asked. "I want him to see that. Leave it there," Gila said. When Nadel returned home, he discovered the mutilated photo. "How can you do that?" he yelled at his fiancé. "How can you poke out Hitler's eyes?" "Hitler is a Schweinhund," she screamed. They argued louder. Nadel defended Hitler and the Reich. Gila could not abide the opinion. The argument ended the same as the others. They still loved each other. A few days later, after Nadel had returned to training, Berlin sustained a massive British bombing. When the explosions ended, Gila found a photo of Hitler and began to climb one of the large gas lanterns that lit the street. At the top, she hung the picture, a symbol of Hitler overseeing the devastation of Germany. She began cursing his name. A policeman arrived and warned her that the Gestapo was on its way. "Go ahead and rage, Gisela," he said. "You have 15 more minutes to curse up and down. Any more and they will pick you up."
"You pig!" Gila screamed. "You already picked up my father. Now you're going to have me picked up, too?"
15 minutes, he said. Less than a year later, Nadel was aboard U-869. He told Gila that he admired Commander Neuerberg and trusted the sub's crew with his life. "When we're out at sea, all we have is each other," he said. Baltic training continued into summer's dog days. At night, U-869's crew were permitted to leave the barracks and spend their free time about the town. In happier days, U-boat crews had enjoyed near-celebrity status during their off-duty hours, guests of honor at the liveliest nightclubs, desired dance partners for the area's prettiest ladies. Now U-869's crew found many of the bars and nightclubs shuttered. Few felt like dancing anyway. Only beer was available to numb the men's worries. When the crew happened upon a band playing in a café, they sat quietly in their uniforms and listened. That summer, First Officer Brandt took a short leave to visit his family in Zinten. He played with his 13-year-old brother, Hans Georg, then enjoyed his mother's turkey and bacon and eggs. As the evening settled, he and his father went into the study and closed the door. Hans Georg tiptoed to the room and pressed his ear against the keyhole. "I am taking a pistol with me on U-869's patrol," Brandt told his father. "I will not wait until the end, should something happen." Hans Georg's heart pounded. What did his brother mean by saying he would not wait until the end? Their religion prohibited the taking of one's own life. Still, Ziggy had said he would not wait until the end. Hans Georg strained to hear more. "I can tell you this," Brandt continued. "I can fully count on each and every one of my men. From the youngest enlistee to Commander Neuerberg, every man aboard U-869 is truly my comrade." At the leave's end, Brandt dressed in his military uniform and kissed his brother and parents goodbye. Before walking out the door, he sat at the piano. He played his favorite song, La Paloma, a longing sailor's lament with the words, "Goodbye, my dove." His mother bit her lip and asked him to stop. The family members hugged one another. A moment later, Brandt disappeared down the street on his way back to U-869. A short time later, Brandt invited Hans Georg and his mother to visit the U-boat in Pilau, where it was stationed for training. Hans Georg could barely contain himself during the train ride. Soon he would see a real, battle-ready U-boat, and one on which his brother was an officer. At the harbor, Brandt picked up his mother and brother in a small boat and took them to a back port where the warships were docked. As the boat approached, Hans Georg picked out U-869 right away. A massive, miraculous sculpture of gray fighting technology. Brand new and proud and invincible. The Olympic rings standing sentinel on the U-boat's conning tower to protect his brother from everything. Brandt invited Hans Georg to board the U-boat, meanwhile apologizing to his mother. Commander Neuerberg did not permit women on his submarine, as he considered their presence aboard bad luck. If she would not mind waiting, he would give Hans Georg a tour. She smiled and agreed. Hans Georg's heart pounded. "This is the greatest moment in my life," he thought to himself. "None of my schoolmates has a brother like mine." The Brandt brothers walked across a rickety wooden gangway to the U-boat. When they reached its deck, Hans Georg saw a man dressed in shorts and with a scarf around his neck lying on his back, sunning himself. The man saw the Brandts and rose. Hans Georg bowed, as was proper for a young man of the day. The man reached and shook Hans Georg's hand. "Ah, this is Brandt Jr.," he exclaimed. "Commander Neuerberg, this is my brother, Hans Georg," Brandt said. "With your permission, I would like to show him the boat." "Of course," Neuerberg said. "We are honored to have him as our guest." Hans Georg stood wide-eyed. All his life he'd known that U-boat men were special, and that U-boat commanders were the most special of all. Now he had met a commander who was tall, handsome, and powerful. And as he walked with his brother across the deck, he knew he was living a truly amazing day, a day when he'd seen a U-boat commander standing on board his submarine in shorts. The Brandts climbed through the conning tower down a smooth, freshly painted metal ladder. Inside, Hans Georg stood mesmerized by the thickets of technology that grew from the walls and ceilings of the boat. Could anyone possibly know the function of all these machines? Brandt began the tour. Hans Georg knew not to touch anything. Brandt showed his brother the diesel engines, the electric motors, the radio room, the torpedoes. Everything smelled of oil. Brandt pointed Hans Georg to his bunk. The boy looked at him as if to ask, "May I?" Brandt nodded. A moment later, Hans Georg was sitting on his brother's bed. At the base of the conning tower, Brandt showed his brother the periscope. "You can look through it," he told Hans Georg. The younger Brandt white-knuckled the periscope's handles and pressed his face to the lens. Before him he saw the harbor's warships, so close that he could read their names. And as he stared at these ships, his brother told him exactly what he was looking at. He knew the name of every warship in the sea. Even though this was a U-boat destined for war, even though Hans Georg knew his brother would be leaving soon, he felt safe with Ziggy standing behind him. "No one," he thought, "has a brother like mine." On August 30, 1944, U-869 was docked at the U-boat flotilla base at Stettin. Already much of the town lay ruined from Allied bombing. That night, the crewmen were awakened in their barracks by the sound of air raid sirens. Some dove into underground bunkers. Others, including Gostrzewski, remained in bed, presuming that the approaching airplanes would bypass Stettin. But when Gostrzewski heard anti-aircraft fire from German ships, he knew the attack was intended for them. He leaped from his bed and rushed toward the bunker. On his way, he noticed that a few men remained in the adjoining barracks. He flung open their door. "People, get out!" he yelled. "This attack is meant for us!" Gostrzewski could hear the bombs falling. He ran for the underground bunker but found its door closed. He beat on it with all his might. A fellow crewman opened the door, and Gostrzewski jumped in. Bombs exploded. The crewman waited inside the bunker. When it was safe to emerge, the men surveyed the area. Craters lay where their barracks had stood. One of U-869's crewmen had been killed in the attack. At the bottom of one of the craters, Neuerberg and Horenberg sifted through charred corpses. As the men climbed out of the crater, The crewmen bowed their heads. Gostchevsky looked at his commander and at the crew. No one said anything, but he could read their thoughts. Each of them, he believed, was thinking, "The war is lost. Why isn't there peace?" The fall season gave the crew a reprieve from the searing summer temperatures, which could reach 110 degrees inside the U-boat. It would now be just a matter of weeks before the boat was assigned a war patrol. In October, however, a scandal hit the submarine. At night, while U-869 was anchored and most men slept ashore, someone stole a large slice of ham from one of the several large hams stored on board. When the cook discovered the theft, he alerted Neuerberg, who summoned the crew. Stealing from comrades, Kameradendiebstahl, was rare aboard a U-boat and was a grave offense in this community bound by fate. Neuerberg raged before the crew. "I cannot assure you that I will not press charges for this theft," he yelled. For a minute, no one moved. Then 24-year-old machinist mate Fritz Dag stepped forward. "I do not want anyone wrongly accused," he said. "I stole the ham." Neuerberg motioned Dag to his quarters. The crew dreaded the punishment Neuerberg was certain to impose on the well-liked Dag. A few minutes later, Dag emerged from Neuerberg's quarters. Neuerberg had not punished him. Instead, the commander told the crew to go about its business. The boat exhaled. Gostchevsky admired the decision. He believed Neuerberg appreciated that Dag felt sick about the theft, and he also knew that Dag, an excellent crewman, could not perform properly if further embarrassed. The men welcomed Dag back to the fold. No one was angry with him. The war was growing more hopeless, but at least everyone had enough to eat. By late October, U-869's crew knew that its maiden war patrol was just a week or two away. Brandt took a one-day leave to visit his family in Zinten. His father gathered the family in the living room and prayed. Siegfried was dressed in his full officer's uniform. He had not even brought along a change of clothes. Snow fell thick outside the window. Otto Brandt asked for peace and the safe return of his sons Siegfried and Norbert. He asked for a time like the one that now seemed from another life, a time when his family could eat and sing and wake up at ease together. Brandt returned to U-869. He was entitled to several more days of home leave. Instead, he gave his remaining share to married crewmen so that they might spend more time with their families. While these men were away, he sat in his tiny bunk aboard the sub and wrote letters to his family. "I learned yesterday," Brandt wrote in one such letter, "that Fritz C., the radioman with whom I always met, did not return from his first war patrol. It was his first deployment at the front. Just a few weeks ago we sat together in a restaurant. That's life, hard and inexorable." In mid-November, he enclosed two small photos of himself, along with a short note that asked his family, "Please think of me." In one photo, he was seated and asleep on the deck of U-869, his knees tucked into his chest, his back against the ship, his head bowed forward. Though his mother owned many photos of Siegfried, this was the only one that made her cry. When Hans Georg asked why she wept at this picture, she told him that it was the way Ziggy was sitting. It reminded her of a child, a baby. And even though Ziggy was a proud warrior, she could still see her little boy in that picture. In late November, Brandt sent another letter to his family. It read, "By the time you receive my letter, I will already have started my journey. I am so glad I heard from Norbert. This way I have certainty. I wish Hans Georg a happy birthday. I hope to be back home for his confirmation. I also wish all of you a merry and blessed and healthy Christmas and New Year. Christmas is a family celebration. even if this time it is only in my thoughts. By thinking of each other, we can remember how nice it used to be. Please don't forget me as you fold your hands, as we carry each other. Let us look forward to our Wiedersehen. As Brandt wrote his letters, and U-869 prepared for its maiden war patrol, Neuerberg made a final visit home. He had joined the U-boats for just such opportunities, and, since 1943, had made the most of them. Upon returning home, he always removed his uniform and changed into civilian clothes, in order to turn back into a mensch, a human being. Often he took his 3-year-old son, Jorgen, sailing with him, towing him behind the boat in a safety ring, and allowing him to pretend to be captain of the ship. On other occasions, to his wife's horror and his son's delight, he placed Jorgen in a small wagon attached to his bicycle, then pedaled as fast as he could. He loved to photograph Jorgen and his year-old daughter, Jutta, and he sent one of Jorgen's shots to a baby powder company for advertising consideration. At night, he and Erna, who had spent much of their marriage separated by his training, listened to music, talked, and fell more deeply in love. He never discussed training or the upcoming mission, except to say that U-869 was manned by a fine and cohesive crew, and that he admired First Officer Siegfried Brandt, not just for his professionalism, but for the way in which he had become friend and comrade to the men. As he and Erna counted down the days until the U-boat's first patrol, they added entries to their baby daybook, a diary they kept for Jorgen and Jutta. His final entry, written to Jorgen before U-869 left on patrol, concluded this way. A few days ago, Mean Tommy, the English, dropped a lot of bombs, and it was very loud. You were very quiet, and you hid your little head under Mommy's coat. Jutta used to laugh during explosions, but she too was very still. It was a terrible night, and as you said, many houses were destroyed. In our house, too, there was a terrible mess. Since then, you don't like to sleep alone, and you want to go nighty-night with Mommy. Even you, my little rascal, are becoming aware of this terrible war. Soon, Daddy will have to go out to sea with his U-boat, and our most ardent hope is that we will all see each other again soon, in good health and in peaceful times. Then, hopefully, you will again wait for me with Mommy and Jutta, and cry out in a happy voice, Mommy, there comes Daddy. May this time not be very far away. May a protecting hand keep you, my dear ones, from terrible things, protect and shield you till a sunny and carefree time reunites us again. Then the sun will shine again on you, my children, and especially on your parents, who live only with and for you, and indescribable happiness will make our life again worth living. With much love, Daddy. In mid-November, U-869 stood just days away from her war patrol. As was customary, the crew created an insignia and motto as an emblem for the boat. Perhaps inspired by the movie Snow White, which the crewmen had recently seen together, they chose as their motto, Hi-Ho, then wrote the words over a drawing of a horseshoe and the number 869. Beneath it, they inscribed a lyric from a popular song by the Swedish singer Zara Leander. It read, I know one day that a miracle will happen, and a thousand dreams will come true. U-869 was scheduled to depart for war around December 1, 1944. In the hours before the boat was to leave, one of Neuerberg's friends, a physician, made a quiet offer. He would write a note to the naval authorities stating that Neuerberg had taken sick and was too ill to command the U-boat. Erna urged her husband to accept the offer. She knew the U-boats were not returning from their patrols. Neuerberg thanked the doctor. He also knew that U-boats were not returning. He had a duty to Germany and to his men. He refused the note. As Neuerberg said goodbye to his family, Erna noticed that he had left something behind.
"You have forgotten your gold pocket watch, Helmut," she said. "Take it with you."
"No," Neuerberg said. "You keep it and count the minutes until I return home."
At around the same time, torpedoman Franz Nedel and a group of his U-869 comrades traveled to his parents' house for a farewell party. His fiancée, Gila, threw her arms around Nedel. His mother went to the kitchen to serve food and drink. Ordinarily, Nedel and his friends already would have been talking and singing and enjoying their free time. Instead, they sat in the living room, still in uniform, and stared straight ahead, saying nothing. Gila's smile slowly faded away at the sight. She looked at the men. One of them began crying, then another, then all of them.
"What is wrong?" Gila asked, rushing to Nedel's side and taking his hand.
For a moment the men could do nothing but cry. Nedel said nothing. Finally, one of the other men spoke.
"None of us is coming back," he said.
"What do you mean by that?" Gila asked. "Of course you're coming back."
"No, we're not coming back," said another.
The men could see Gila's face flush as she strained to contain her tears.
"Well, Franz will come back, but none of us will," said another.
"That makes no sense," she protested. "If Franz comes back, you will all come back."
The men shook their heads and kept crying.
Nadel's mother was devastated by the sight. Still, she pulled herself together and stepped forward.
"Come on, boys, lie down and get a good night's sleep. You will stay here. Gila will stay here. You will feel better in the morning."
The next morning the men dressed and rode the train with Engelmann and Nadel's mother back to U-869's dock. Gila did not let go of Nadel's hand during the hours-long trip. No one mentioned the events of the previous night. No one said much of anything. At the gate, the women were given permission to accompany the men to the U-boat so that they might wave goodbye. U-869 was to leave on its war patrol that day. To reach the submarine, the women boarded a tiny boat that took them to a small island. There, Gila saw U-869 for the first time, a magnificent and proud machine in which her future lay. Nedel took her hand.
"Gila, please wait for me," he said. "You won't be sorry. I will take good care of you."
"Of course I'll wait," she said.
"Pray for me when I leave."
"Of course I will."
Gila and Nedel's mother stood near the boat. They were joined by only two or three other family members. The men lined up in rows on the U-boat's deck, just as they had during its commissioning nearly a year ago. A four-man band made its way to the dock and played a melancholy German folk song. The U-boat began to move away from its dock. Nedel and the other crewmen stayed on the deck and waved, though most of them had no family or friends to wave to. A few minutes later, the U-boat disappeared into the overcast horizon. Chapter 13 The U-boat is our moment. Since 1991, Chatterton and Kohler had believed in history. Every book, expert, and document listed U-869 as sunk off Gibraltar. Now, 2.5 years later, the intercepted radio messages between U-869 and U-boat control virtually proved that the New Jersey U-boat was U-869. The divers dug deep into their filing cabinets for U-869's crew roster, one of several dozen such lists Chatterton had copied at the U-boat archive in Germany. Kohler, who understood the German rank and position abbreviations, called Chatterton and read him the basics. "There are 56 crewmen listed," Kohler said. "A guy named Neuerberg was the commander, He was born in 1917, which would have made him, what, 27 years old? The first officer was, let's see, Brandt, Siegfried Brandt. Christ, he was only 22. Here's our friend Horenberg, the Funkmeister, age 25. There were four Willies aboard and three Wilhelms. Hey, there was even a Richard and a Johann. That's like Richie and John.
How young did they go? Chatterton asked. Kohler did some computations.
There are 24 teenagers, he said. The youngest was Otto Britzius. When U-869 left on war patrol, he was 17.
We've been swimming past these guys and bumping into their bones for 3 seasons, and never had a clue who they were, Chatterton said. Now we know their names.
Word of the radio intercepts flashed through the U-boat community. To many experts, the mystery of the New Jersey U-boat was now solved. Originally ordered to New York, the submarine had missed her rerouting instructions to Gibraltar and had continued on to New Jersey, where she had sunk. Chatterton and Kohler also believed the mystery to be solved. But they were not prepared to close the book on U-869. The wreck still had not surrendered evidence that conclusively proved her identity. The most ornery skeptics might still argue that the U-Who was, in fact, U-857, as the divers had earlier theorized. U-857 had, after all, gone missing on the American East Coast and remained unaccounted for. They could argue that Horenberg's knife had been stolen or misplaced, and had ended up on U-857 as that submarine lay tied up near U-869 in Norway before its battle patrols. However unlikely this scenario, it presented a sobering reality for Chatterton and Kohler. Until, say, a tag marked U-869 or a builder's plaque engraved with a hull number was recovered from the U-boat, no one could conclude with absolute certainty that the wreck was U-869. Chatterton and Kohler made a decision. They would return to the wreck. Their fellow divers recoiled at the idea. 3 men had died diving the U-boat. Others had come close. No accessible areas remained to be explored. "You guys know it's U-869," their colleagues protested. "No one's disputing it. You rewrote history. Why risk your lives?" Chatterton and Kohler responded identically. "We need to know for ourselves." To Chatterton, quitting the U-Who now would have been tantamount to quitting himself. For years he had lived and dived according to a single set of principles, a belief that hard work, perseverance, thoroughness, preparation, creativity, and vision made the diver and the man. He had overlaid his life philosophy onto scuba and had become one of the world's great wreck divers. He had overlaid his diving ethos onto his daily existence and found himself leading an honorable and gratifying life. He could not walk away from the U-Who, just short of certain. To Kohler, the U-Who had evolved from an artifact site into a moral obligation. Alone among the divers, he felt it his duty to give names to the fallen crewmen and closure to their families. Like Chatterton, he was now certain that the U-Who was U-869. But he could not announce to the Neuerberg or Brandt or Horenberg families that he was pretty sure their brothers and sons died off New Jersey, that U-869 had probably sunk in American waters rather than off Africa. He, too, penciled in summer dates to dive the U-Who. He could not leave question marks hanging over these men any more than he'd been able to accept seeing dead bodies left behind in the water during his boyhood boating trips with his father. He would search for a tag or some other indisputable proof. He would give the dead their rest and the families their names. A final motivation drove Chatterton and Kohler back to the U-Who, one upon which they agreed to the last detail. They were making history, and they intended to do it correctly. Time and again during their research, they had been astonished to discover that historians had been mistaken, books fallible, experts wrong. The Yoo-hoo was their chance to personally imprint history. They would not do it in a less-than-perfect way. As spring signaled the start of the 1994 dive season, Chatterton set his mind to breaking new ground on the Yoo-hoo. The previous season had been the diver's most productive, yielding excellent artifacts and access to unexplored areas. But it had also left Chatterton at a loss. Every accessible compartment on the submarine had been combed over several times. Every idea about where to find an identifying tag or marking had been tested. He drew blueprints on coffee shop napkins, but found their lines identical to those he had sketched in 1991. He recommitted to seeing order in garbaged piles of randomness. But he could not envision fresh territory inside the sub in which to use this skill. April, traditionally a month of optimism and anticipation for Chatterton, began to darken for his inability to conceive a new plan. Every so often, at night, while his wife slept beside him, Chatterton would lie on his back and stare at the ceiling and wonder why his art, this way of seeing a wreck in ways others could not fathom, was failing him when he needed it most. Those were the times Kohler seemed divinely sent. Chatterton would hear the phone ring, or receive a fax, or see the Fox glass truck in his driveway, and it would be Kohler, pushing, cajoling, stroking, insisting. Wisps of disgust blended into his thickening Brooklyn accent as he cocked an eyebrow at Chatterton's lament. "Look, John," Kohler would say, "I don't mean to be impolite or nothing, but I gotta ask, what the hell is wrong with you? What's happening to you? Nothing stops us. We're the guys. I'll go to the U-boat today. It's April. It's 40 goddamn degrees, and I'll go. And I'll drag your ass down there, and we'll think of a plan while we're hanging on the anchor line if we have to. Someone's gonna pull a tag from that wreck. You want to sit here and cry while one of Belanda's boys do it? You want to watch some greenhorn get it stuck to his fin and come out and be the guy? We're going to do it. We're the guys." "Thanks, Richie," Chatterton would say. "You're exactly what I need right now." Then Chatterton would reach for a pen and a napkin and start another blueprint. As the Atlantic warmed itself, Kohler's longing for his family deepened. He had never fully appreciated the depth of pleasure he took in full-time fatherhood, nor the undergirding importance of that role to his self-image. For years, he had considered himself a diver. Now, as his children began to know a new life and new adult figures in their new home, Kohler realized that he considered himself a father most of all. "I can't live without my kids," he told himself. "I love my kids more than diving. I love my kids more than anything. I'll do anything to get them back." Kohler began to contemplate the impossible. He called Chatterton. They met at Scotty's. Kohler stared into his martini glass and told Chatterton that any reconciliation with Felicia would require him to give up diving. Chatterton glared. "Ultimatums don't work," Chatterton said. "Marriages don't work when one person says, 'You and I will be fine together as long as you do what I say.' She wants you to give up diving? That alone shows that Felicia doesn't understand what you're made of. Diving is in your soul. How do you agree to give up your soul?" "It's for my family," Kohler said. "If I have to give up diving to save my family, I'll do it." "That's great, Richie," Chatterton said, his face reddening. "You're on the verge of putting the final pieces of the U-boat puzzle together, and you're going to walk away. If I leave diving, I know it's going to affect you, too. "Forget about me," Chatterton exploded. "Being a diver is who you are."
For a minute, neither man spoke. "This is a long road, John," Kohler said finally. "I love my kids. They're already learning to live without me. I gotta really think this through."
Chatterton began to hear from Kohler less often. In those moments of doubt when Chatterton could not contemplate where to go next on the U-boat, those moments when Kohler had always seemed to materialize and light a fire under him, now there was silence. In his office late one summer night, Kohler sat at his desk and pulled out a loaded 9mm pistol. He was a diver. It was who he was. He needed his children and his family. He was a father. It was who he was. He put his finger on the trigger and drew the gun closer. A million images sped through his brain like a film that had come loose from the projector's sprockets. Should he shoot himself in the temple or the mouth? He was a diver. It was who he was. Would it hurt? A man needs his family. Children should know their father. He lifted the gun. He looked at a photo of his children on the corner of his desk. If he killed himself, they would grow up with only Felicia's account of who he was. A one-sided account. They would never really know him. And his bloody head would just be proof of what she inevitably would tell them. But Daddy was a loser who'd left his family. He looked deeper into the photo. "I want to smell my daughter's hair. I want to teach my son to ride a mini-bike. I miss them." He put the gun back in the drawer. A short time later, Kohler called Felicia. He told her he wanted his family back. She gave him two ultimatums. First, he would have to join her for marriage counseling. Second, he would have to give up diving. He told Chatterton the news that night at Scotty's. Kohler had never seen his friend so disgusted.
"I agreed to it, John," Kohler said. "I was getting so kooky that if she'd asked me to paint my ass pink and walk backwards, I would have done that, too. I missed my family."
"You're walking away from diving?"
"I'm walking away from diving."
"It's not you, Richie. It's a big, goddamned, colossal mistake."
Kohler stared into his martini. Chatterton had become one of his best friends. But this night he thought, "John is not the gentlest person on these issues." A month later, Kohler and his family reconciled and rented a house in suburban Middletown, New Jersey. At his office, across from the desk at which he had contemplated taking his life, he packed his U-boat work. The research, photos, documents, theories, artifacts, correspondence, translations, into a file cabinet, and locked the drawer. He did not call Chatterton to tell him this part. That day, Kohler began his new life as an ex-diver. Chatterton's first trip to the Yoo-Hoo in 1994 was booked for the first weekend in July. He had spent months wrestling with a single question. Where do I go next on the wreck? On the eve of the dive, he still had no answer. Every accessible inch of the submarine had been searched. Some divers and observers had begun to whisper that no one would ever pull proof of the U-boat's identity from the wreck. Others insisted that a lucky greenhorn would find a tag stuck to the side of his face mask. Such talk was maddening to Chatterton. Yet he found himself unable to make a convincing counter-argument. He commanded himself to be creative. Nothing happened. He forced himself to write a list of ideas. Each was the same as in previous seasons. When friends saw the distress in his face and asked of his well-being, he could only reply, "I'm not myself. I'm out of ideas.
The July trip to the Yoo-Hoo was as Chatterton expected. He rolled off the boat without a plan. He swam the wreck without priorities. He looked at the periscope for the builder's plaque, just as he had done 3 years earlier. Topside, he listened for Kohler to light the fire under his ass, to hear Kohler call him a pussy in just the right way. But Kohler was 100 miles away with his family and a locked file cabinet, and the boat sounded silent that day. He told Yerga, "Without a vision, I'm wasting my time." As if to exact revenge against the Yoo-Hoo, Chatterton turned his creative fury to the hunt for other shipwrecks. In July 1994 alone, he discovered and identified the tanker Norness, the first ship sunk by a U-boat on the American side of the Atlantic during World War II, and discovered the Sebastian, a World War I-era passenger liner sunk by fire and storm 8 miles east of the Andrea Doria. While Chatterton made these historic discoveries, Kohler undertook a dry-docked life in suburbia. He had resolved to repair his family so that he would never again face the prospect of losing his children. He tiptoed around Felicia, screwed up enthusiasm for family grocery trips, tried not to say, "This is bullshit," during their marriage counseling. He bought his and her bicycles. Summoning facial muscles he'd never known he owned, he smiled as Felicia announced vacation plans to Disney World. Occasionally he would slip. Pushing a baby stroller on a calm and sunny Sunday, he might remark, "I bet the ocean's like glass for those guys today." "I don't want to hear that," Felicia would say, stopping and glaring. "You're dreaming about diving? Don't you want to be with us?" "Of course I do, honey," Kohler would say. Then he would keep walking and repeat his silent mantra. "I'm disgusted and I'm angry, but it's for the kids. It's for the kids. I love my family. It's for the kids." In the beginning, Chatterton called regularly. "Richie, I'm going to the U-boat. You in?" "Nah, I can't commit," Kohler would answer. "What do you mean you can't commit? Richie, this is insane. You can't live like this." Kohler's insides were shredding. But he would only say, "I'm sorry, John." When he got word that weather kept blowing out Chatterton's U-boat trips, he found himself feeling guilty for his sense of relief. Kohler steeled his resolve and stayed out of diving. Between the cracks, he drip-fed his passions. He continued to hoard catalogs from the military book clubs, buying every volume that touched remotely on U-boats, cupping the phone receiver to surreptitiously check inventory with book dealers who knew his appetites. He bought a U-boat video game that contained a bonus wall map of the German naval grids, then compared that map to the handmade version he had fashioned from his research in Washington. Among his biggest thrills in 1994 was the closeness with which he found these maps to match. Kohler expected the onset of fall to provide some respite from his longings. Instead, he found himself thinking about the Yoo-Hoo's crewmen. For years, he had envisioned the horror of their final moments. The explosion, singed bodies flung upside down, an ocean rushing in. Now that he knew their names, he began to imagine their lives. He pictured Germany as his father had when listening to Mr. Siegel's stories. A land not of goose-stepping soldiers, but of families and girlfriends, hometowns, regional delicacies, and plans. He read the crew list and wondered who among the men liked movies and who liked music, whether they rooted for local soccer clubs, if any had written his girlfriend's name on a torpedo tube hatch. He could imagine their lives even to the final hours, a can of peaches awarded to the boat's checkers champion, the cook burning sausages, the radioman playing a phonograph record. As winter crawled over New Jersey, these thoughts became an obligation to Kohler. More than ever, he believed that he owed these men a duty, that they must not lie in an anonymous grave with their fate unknown to their loved ones. And it occurred to Kohler that he likely remained the last person in the world inclined to identify these men. Yet he was unable to move, bound by his own family obligations. And it struck him as strange that his commitment to his family was the very promise preventing him from doing right by the crewmen's families. Kohler watched the snow fall outside his rented home. For years, snow had meant that Kohler was just a few months from returning to the ocean. This year, he felt like he had never been further from himself, and the snow seemed as if it would keep falling forever. In early 1995, Chatterton and Kohler met for dinner. But this time it was at a pizza joint, not Scotty's. In previous years, when the men were themselves, their dinners had lasted for hours. This night it lasted a slice.
"You staying out this year, too?" Chatterton asked.
"Yeah," Kohler replied. "I gotta stick with this. Felicia's driving me crazy, but I gotta see this through for the kids."
"Uh-huh."
"Any trademark Chatterton breakthroughs on the Yoo-hoo?"
"It's all I think about.
I have no ideas. I'm blind."
"What about the other divers? What's their direction?"
"Richie, no one wants to go there anymore."
At home, Kohler was white-knuckling his marriage just to keep it breathing. He had entered marriage counseling, rented a house, locked away his dive gear. Still, the fights grew worse. In the early spring of 1995, he wrote Felicia a 12-page letter, took off his wedding band, then stuffed his clothes and belongings into a dozen hefty steel sacks, and moved onto his friend's floor in Levittown, Pennsylvania. He was nearly bankrupt from the spending that had been required to repair his family. For a few months, Kohler took custody of his kids every weekend, summoning just enough strength to shave and get off the floor so that his 5-year-old son and 2-year-old daughter would believe Daddy was doing great. That lasted a few months. In July 1995, Kohler took over custody of the children. He was ecstatic. He called a real estate agent and requested a home in the best school district within a 25-mile radius of his Trenton, New Jersey shop. 2 weeks later, he and his children moved to a townhouse in Yardley, Pennsylvania. He hired an au pair, registered his kids in school, scrounged up money for decorations for their rooms, and laid down family rules. On the other side of New Jersey, bad weather limited Chatterton to just a single Yoo-hoo trip. As in 1994, he dove the submarine without a plan and came up empty. Stonewalled by the U-boat, he threw the entirety of his creative muscle into the quest he had started the previous year. Nothing less than the discovery of several historic, undiscoverable shipwrecks. He picked up his work on the SS Carolina, a passenger liner sunk by U-boat gunfire during World War I. To East Coast wreck divers, there was no greater prize than the Carolina, a beautiful vessel from which 197 passengers and 117 crew had been ordered into lifeboats 60 miles offshore before U-151 sank the ship. 13 drowned when their lifeboat capsized overnight. Divers had spent decades searching for the Carolina, all to no avail. She remained the only undiscovered passenger liner in New York, New Jersey waters. Chatterton spent the off-season translating and studying German records, interviewing a shipyard archivist, poring over the captain's log, examining 77-year-old weather charts. He then assembled his research and put together a vision. He believed the Carolina lay in an area no diver had suspected. On his first trip to the site, Chatterton found a wreck. He cleared sea anemones from the fantail, where his research indicated he would find the ship's name. There he began to uncover brass letters, C-A-R-O-L-I-N-A. In a single day, he had found and identified the SS Carolina, for decades the most coveted prize among Northeast wreck divers. A few weeks later, Chatterton made a trip to a wreck that some suspected was the freighter Texel, another ship sunk by a U-boat during World War I. Chatterton devised a plan based on his study of Texel photographs and deck plans. He would search the bow area for reference points like portholes that he knew to be positioned near the ship's name. Legendary diver Gary Gentile assured him that the bow was too busted up to yield the name. Chatterton went anyway. He found the brass letters. They spelled Texel. In the course of a year, Chatterton had discovered and or identified four historic shipwrecks. Some began to call him the greatest wreck diver in the world. He sank further into despair. Chatterton redoubled his efforts to crack the Yoo-hoo. He drew blanks. Ideas flowed into his head for other projects, mosaics of imagination, perseverance, and vision, that promised discovery in whatever he fancied, except for the Yoo-hoo. At conferences at which he was asked to speak about diving the Lusitania or the Carolina or his other recent accomplishments, people invariably asked about the U-boat, a subject so depressing to Chatterton that he stopped attending these events. For the first time in his career, Chatterton heard the clock tick. He was 43 years old, already an elder statesman in a sport that wore down athletes half his age. Divers no longer wanted to explore the Yoo-hoo. If Chatterton got bent or broke bones in a car accident or developed cancer, the submarine likely never would be identified. Then the casual and the lazy would simply waltz in and proclaim it U-869. "We're virtually certain of it," they would announce. Nightmare words to an artist. Yet Chatterton was at a loss as to what to do next. Nightly, he lay awake in bed, telling the ceiling and the heavens that he would do anything to pull proof from the wreck, that he would help anyone who had an idea, that he would share his knowledge, that he would risk his life inside that U-boat if only he could conceive a vision. Friends like Jurga told him, "You've got to cut yourself a break. You've done more in the last year than most great wreck divers do in a lifetime." In his darkest moments, Chatterton brushed cheeks with the idea of quitting. He imagined a time when he could run out for pizza or take his car for a spin without seeing the Yoo-hoo's crushed control room before him, a time when he no longer wondered if he was who he hoped he was. The fantasy always felt good for a minute. But it always ended with Chatterton thinking, "When things are easy, a person doesn't really learn about himself. It's what a person does at the moment of his greatest struggle that shows him who he really is. Some people never get that moment. The Yoo-hoo is my moment. What I do now is what I am." When he thought that, Chatterton would snap out of his brush with quitting, sit down at his desk in front of Horenberg's knife, and start drawing sketches of the places on the Yoo-hoo he planned to go next. Now separated from Felicia, Kohler began to receive invitations to go diving. The first came from Chatterton. Kohler told him what he would tell all his friends that season. "I can't dive. I physically and mentally can't do it. My head's not in it. I'll die." As the 1995 dive season wound down, Kohler continued as a full-time father and businessman. He slept irregularly, running to midnight emergency business calls and making French toast for his kids when he returned. His children settled into a routine. In September 1995, Kohler went to the Hudson City Savings Bank to do a glass job. There he met a very pretty,
30-year-old blue-eyed blonde, who complained of a problem door. When Kohler deduced that part of the problem was that the woman had been kicking the door with her high heels, he took a liking to her. The woman,